writings, etc. And the second part is on the regulation of these guidelines. How can we improve how to attest to the legitimacy or quality control and regulation of guidelines? So that's what I'll be presenting on today. That's more on the guidelines for guideline development. And so my overall question that I was trying to answer was, in the views of guideline developers themselves, what is a good guideline, and which instruments, practices, writings can ensure the production of such guidelines? And this really came out of the existing literature that was so polarized, as Timmermans and Epstein have described, for standards in very general terms. There's two standard narratives, which we also see in these EBM standards. So on the one hand, standards are good. They represent best practice. They're ideals to live up to, particularly based on universal evidence. They're meant to rationalize practices. As a quality standard, they can provide an external accountability. So on the one hand, there's these very high promises that guidelines can rationalize a diversity of practices. On the other hand, there's much critique on standards, the effects of standards. Standardization is typically considered derogative. It connotates a dull sameness, the suppression of individuality in the service of industrial uniformity, as Timmermans and Epstein put it. And so in terms of evidence-based guidelines or standards, we see this type of critique as well in the literature. As Mikulovsky and Weir have summarized it, they're often abstract and normative critiques. Have separated them in two different categories, political economy critique and humanist critique. And so under the term cookbook medicine, both EBM as a larger undertaking and particularly guidelines as a very important tool to achieve that evidence-based medicine have been criticized, in which guidelines, rather than these universal gold standards that can rationalize medicine, are considered or feared to be a kind of dehumanizing recipe that produces this industrial uniformity. Particularly the evidence hierarchy has been critiqued for privileging the randomized clinical trials, of course, which are mostly produced by pharmaceutical industry. In terms of these treatment guidelines, by privileging this kind of evidence, that they would ignore things, that they would ignore much more complex or social or political solutions that are not easily tested in randomized clinical trials. In terms of standardization, a fear of standardization, that they bring about a suppression of individuality, both of the physicians whose situated judgment and tested skills, the clinical skills, are ignored in favor of this quantitative evidence, and patients are treated as mere numbers rather than their individual clinical characteristics and values are taken into account. Much of the STS literature has challenged these polarized images of standardization and looked at standardization differences in practice, have shown how in practice standards are much more diverse. They bring about different kinds of standardization. Standards themselves are very diverse, and the consequences they have are both good and bad and often unintended. And standardization is never complete, so rather than just replacing the diversity in practices, it creates new disorders, as Timmermans and Berg put it. Under the term local universality, they have emphasized how when guidelines or standards are being used, the guidelines themselves or standards themselves are modified and adjusted to the practices. And so it's never... standardization never leads to a simple homogeneity, but new differences and new practices are produced. And so these tensions are inherent in standardization, the tensions between universal and local, between quantitative evidence or judgments. These are all part and parcel of all standards. One does not simply replace the other. So the first part of my dissertation looked at production of EBM guidelines, and as others have also shown, when you look at a guideline development in practice, the evidence base itself is much more pragmatic and diverse, as then the formal evidence hierarchy would lead us to believe, while this hierarchy might be all the complexity and messiness of practice may have been erased, but when we look at practices of actual guideline development, we see that the evidence base is much more diverse, and both in terms of what gets counted as evidence or how evidence is selected, and also in terms of what are the, is the diversity of knowledge that can justify a guideline is more diverse. Here I'd like to emphasize not simply pointing out this complexity and diversity and pragmatism of practice, but looking at how the discrepancy between that much more pragmatic reality and the formalist principles of EBM are managed. How do guideline developers themselves make sense of this more contextualized pragmatism within the formalist universal principles of EBM that they equally support and are committed to? And so rather than portraying this gap between that pragmatic practice and the universality of the principles as a resistance or rejection of EBM, nor do I think it's that they simply support the EBM principles in a kind of a, just a simple rhetoric, or do they, neither do they see it as a flaw to be remedied by more rules or more universality, but these guideline developers admit, reveal, and legitimize this pragmatism and contextualization of guideline development and practice. And I suggest that the term meta-regulation, so the development of guidelines for guideline development, helps them, these EBM standard setters, to legitimize some of the local and cultural and contextual, but within the principles of EBM. So aiming to embrace both these sides as good practice. And adjusting and transforming both of these things in the process. So just a quick overview, I'll talk about the emergence of this international regulation of guidelines and give two examples of guidelines for guidelines, so instruments that aim to regulate and improve guideline development, and then close with talking a little bit about some of the implications of these guidelines for guidelines in terms of the kinds of standardization and the kinds of rationalities in medicine. And so the emergence of this international regulation was really a result of the success of guidelines in the late 90s. Guidelines were proliferating so rapidly, they still are, due to high promises. So many organizations, different countries, professional organizations, governments were all producing their own guidelines, which really challenges the whole idea of guidelines as universal rational standards, as double standards were being created, guidelines with conflicts from country to country or from two different specialty disciplines. So this raised the question, which amongst these double standards is the true gold standard, as they were meant to reduce practice variations. They now seem to really reflect those practice variations themselves. So standards themselves were in need of regulation. And so a lot of international guideline developers got together from several European countries, from Canada, from New Zealand, to address this issue of contradictory guidelines. Instead of standardizing the guidelines themselves and proposing a kind of globalized standard that they would develop together, they were firmly opposed to the idea of having globalized standards or universal guidelines. And instead, they legitimized the variation in standards and the diversity, writing, "Each country has its own norms and values that influence the content and presentation of guidelines. Therefore, the aim should not be to develop international guidelines." Yet they still wanted to collaborate on an international level, working together with guideline developers from all over the world. And their aim was to create a kind of universal standard setting procedure, hence the guidelines for guidelines rather than a standardization of the guidelines. So they, their aim was to reach international agreement about the requirements for methodology and reporting of guidelines rather than the content of the guidelines themselves. So this led to the Guidelines International Network, which is a network of about 400 different guideline organizations and associated organizations that get together every year. They produce a variety of instruments, and in their annual meeting, guideline developers come to learn new techniques to address different problems together, to learn about guideline development, etc. And so they're very active still. Two of the different instruments that they developed to regulate this uncontrollable guideline development that was happening, still is happening, is the AGREE instrument. This was really the first instrument that came out of this international collaboration between all these guideline developers and made it possible to set this quality control of guidelines on the methodology of guidelines rather than the evidence or the clinical validity. So AGREE, this is just a small image of it. It's a checklist. It contains 23 steps of what good guideline development should include. And it's not just an ideal of what guideline development should be, what already did exist, but they really make a test, as Lawrence Bush calls it, a test. This standard is also a test of what whether it is a good guideline, and so it's a checklist, and it gives a quantitative score at the end, and so you have a measure of whether this guideline is high or low quality, etc. And so this really allowed for the quality control of guidelines without a standardization of guidelines. So basing the quality on methodological process rather than the quantity or quality of the evidence base, nor the clinical validity of the recommendations themselves. Those could be varied, but the methodological process was the basis for the quality. And so this idea that universal process, but local guidelines, so the quality of guidelines can be controlled, guidelines can be regulated, but diversity can also be maintained. So there's no longer this idea that rational guidelines or good guidelines are universal guidelines. And so with evidence not being the main or the only guarantee for the quality of guidelines, it does raise the question of, are these evidence-based guidelines or are they process-based guidelines? And so I just want to emphasize how the guideline developers do emphasize the importance of evidence-based medicine, that their guidelines are evidence-based. One of the guidelines for guideline is the GRADE standard, which is the global standard for evidence hierarchies. So the evidence hierarchy really is, I guess, the quintessential EBM quality that is part of the guidelines for guidelines. And so what GRADE aims, it's developed or led by Gordon Gayat, who was at McMaster University, who was the person who coined the term evidence-based medicine. So this is really encouraged and led by EBMers themselves. And GRADE aims to both standardize, but at the same time diversify evidence hierarchy. On the one hand, they want to become the global standard, the single one evidence hierarchy, as there currently are hundreds or maybe thousands of evidence hierarchies that are all slightly different around the world. They want to have a single standard for all guideline developers to use. But at the same time, they do diversify the more classical evidence hierarchy. So just to show you quickly what GRADE does, the evidence assessment, it supplements the classical evidence hierarchy, which is based on methodological study design only. So I don't know if I can point at this. I guess here, the study design, this is the typical criteria that are usually in part as part of evidence assessment, but then there are five additional criteria that upgrade or downgrade the quality of evidence, and particularly this criteria of indirectness is a really interesting way to try and get a more contextualized quality of evidence. And so in terms of using the GRADE process, what is good evidence? The quality of evidence in GRADE is really context dependent. And so Gayat says, what is direct evidence from one population in one context? Maybe indirect evidence, and there's lower quality because of the way we define quality. And so there's really this acknowledgement that the production, the context of production of RCTs itself is highly specialized, and the validity of that research depends on the similarities between the context of production and the context of use. And so there's not this idea that RCT research is context-free and can simply be transferred, but there is a transformation that has to take place. Within the GRADE procedure, there's instructions on how to make this transfer happen. And so on the one hand, this transformation can be of practice. That practice needs to mimic the trial protocol, that the populations and context, et cetera, needs to be very similar. And if that's not the case, then there also can be a transformation of the evidence, that is a quality reduction. I think this this basis is a different kind of objectivity for EBM. It has been largely associated with a mechanical type of objectivity, where a subjectivity would be erased and excluded, and all the clinical messiness would be erased. With this grade, there is an attempt to not aim for this mechanical objectivity. Guillot puts it, the merit of grade is not that it eliminates judgment, since there is judgment involved. It's not that it eliminates disagreement. Its great merit is that it makes this judgment explicit and transparent, provides a structure for the judgment. So the outcomes are not standardized, while the procedure is perceived to be universal. There's no expectation that the outcomes are universal in workshops when people are using grade. Small groups using grade based on the same evidence, they would have different outcomes. They would have different levels of quality, and the leaders of the workshop, the grade people, would say that is totally fine. It depends on your judgment. Even though the workshop participants did not like that, they wanted rules on how to use these criteria. They wanted to have a standardized outcome, but grade says no. That's not what we provide. We only provide a structure, and you have to use your own judgment, etc. And so, I do want to emphasize how creating a standardized reporting infrastructure, while it does not automate, it does not simply reveal a process unaltered either, as we already know from lots of research on standards and classification. Whenever you make something visible, other things become invisible and obscured. So, just to talk a little bit about what I think are kind of the implications, or what these guidelines for guidelines make possible for guidelines. On the one hand, they challenge those standard narratives, emphasizing that guidelines should be localized, though what exactly the local is not specified. They should be contextualized. Where that context exactly is located, it might differ. But there's no aim for a kind of globalized medicine. This is very much rejected. So multiple standards are envisioned, and standardization itself is very diverse, appears in all sorts of forms and colors. And so as Timmermans and Berg have shown for when during the use of guidelines, practices are incorporated into those standards during use, what they call local universality. This really pulls that local universality towards guideline production, where we can also see that local practices are incorporated. Toon Zuiderend has suggested a different kind of what he calls situated standardization, where local practices are built into guideline development from the start, but in this kind of standardization, he sees both the practice, the process of developing guidelines, to be completely localized and contextualized. He kind of wants to entirely merge the process of developing guidelines and using guidelines and have a single process of situated standardization, which is a locally kind of experimentation. So meta-regulation differs from both of these, that it looks at kind of local universality in the process of guidelines. But the process itself is aimed to be universal. The guidelines for guidelines are supposed to be valid across countries and organizations, etc., while the clinical practice guidelines, the outcomes themselves, are to be localized. So this universal process, although not an automated process. And so within these EBM standards, developers, they aim for a kind of local universality from the start. So we could call this a local rationality, as local universality is not just the result of using guidelines in practice, but it's also built in from the start. There's not an aim for kind of a universal truth with these guideline developers. And in terms of new rationalities in medicine, as Cambrosio and colleagues have already suggested, that EBM is much more than a simple regime change from rule by experts to rule by numbers. It's not simply mechanical objectivity that replaces expert judgments. Those are both the numbers and experts are there, and there's an emergence of more and more procedural rules to coordinate those experts and their judgment and the numbers together. But there's also differences between what we see happening in the clinical practice guidelines as compared to other standards that have been analyzed and have been suggested to operate under this regulatory objectivity. And so, but while there's no aim for universal truth in a lot of the standards under regulatory objectivity, there is an aim for a standardization, that these standards do aim for comparability, that the outcomes of the standards should be standardized. Even if those standards might be arbitrary to a certain extent, what's really important is that in laboratory standards or regulatory categories, that there is a standard that everybody produces the same outcomes. There is really that emphasis on that, which we don't see in the clinical practice guidelines. The standard really needs to be improved over the current practice. There is a real a quality improvement aim. It's not that any standard is better than no standard. And because of this lack of standards, the process does not lead to reproducible or comparable outcomes. I think this might explain why there is even a kind of a hyper concern with transparency, as this can be used to prove kind of the objectivity of the process. Even if the outcomes differ, because of the transparency, the process itself has a legitimacy and an objectivity. That was how I see the meta regulation and guidelines for guidelines. Thank you.
I found your discussion very interesting. I appreciate your presentation of the idea that EBM can be challenged differently, not only classically discussing the importance of numbers, lamenting the oblivion of the person, of the subject. And you present, in your terms, the new science of guidelines. Mm-hmm. And this new science of guidelines will make, again, in your own terms, the universal local. Okay. In a way, which is very interesting for all of us, you show that it's these guideliners who, in fact, do exactly like socio-anthropologists. They help to deconstruct EBM. So in a way, we are doing the same kind of work. But they are not located in the same place as we are. And that's my problem. Where are these people who discuss and regulate the production of EBM? You show very nicely how it could lead to a regression. We have guidelines, then we have guidelines regulators, that we could have guideline regulation. And where can we stop this regression? You ask the question, don't have an answer. You cannot have all answers. So my question is, where are these regulators, this new administration of guidelines located? You say that these people are composed of various types of professionals, including doctors, but probably doctors, you can imagine, are have gone a long way from the initial practice and become administrators, as some of them, some of us have experience just leaving the clinic. So where are these authorities? And where do they draw the authority from? The place is important. I suppose that this place is located not in any country, but in some countries you don't mention.
There is no place.
Okay. Yeah. And you draw, in a way, a platform from above, but we don't know. Maybe it's like a magic carpet. It's just flying over the heads. And I know the platform because of it's a familiar term for Alberto Cambrosio. Platform, he was a lover of platforms. And so how can the conclusion of these guideliners, how can they be received, understood, and finally challenged at the lowest level? That's another question. A last remark before giving the turning to the audience. I think your problematic is already very encompassing. You have a large scope.
Yes.
And in a way, it's very abstract. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, it could be still more abstract, because you could include in your discussion, finally, all byproducts of EBM. I mean, for example, the models suggested for action in the third world, in the developing countries, all these models, all these packages for public health, mm-hmm. which are just sent from above and diffused across borders from Europe, from the United States to Africa, mm-hmm. and up to Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your comments. So you're asking about the location of the guideline developers and the place and where are they and who are they? Well, there really isn't a place. The place where the guideline development, the guidelines international network, and also GRADE has working groups. These are really guideline developers that work in their everyday life in their own countries or their own organizations. It's mostly, like I said, European countries or Western countries. Australia, some US guideline developers, and so the individual members are from those different organizations, and they get together at an international conference, which moves from North America to Europe to outside those two continents somewhere else every year. They get together online, through email, exchanges, through other, they attach, a lot of them will attend Cochrane conferences, and so they'll meet there. And so it really is very international in terms of where they are. And it's a network, as they describe themselves. There is very little, there is kind of an office that helps organize this conference, but besides the conference and the instruments that they develop in international working groups, that's the kind of formal structure that they have. And who they are, a lot of them are part of guideline development organizations in different countries. So a lot of them are kind of national guideline developers. If, in, for example, NICE in the UK and the Netherlands has CBO, which is develops guidelines for a country. Or in Canada, it's very much provincial. So there's provincial guideline developers. And it's true that some of them are medical professionals in their background, but mostly what they do in their daily life is produce guidelines and do research on guidelines. And so they are a kind of professional group that is very hybrid, that doesn't really exist. Some are epidemiologists or biostatisticians, some are librarians. They all have come at this from very different professional backgrounds. But now that what they do is develop guidelines. And some really do have clinical practice as well. Some are practicing doctors. There's not that many of them, but some are, and they do get a kind of special, I'm not sure if I'd call it authority, but it's definitely something that's kind of appreciated, that because then you really know what's really happening on the ground. So, and where do they draw their authority from? Well, I guess they don't have an institutionalized kind of authority. They are in a... The whole idea of collaborating internationally has a certain prestige, but yeah, I don't think they have a kind of classical authority, as in an institutional authority or a professional authority. It's a very hybrid, diverse kind of group, and their instruments provide the authority, that the instruments are supported by many guideline developers around the world, is definitely something that helps them, help these guidelines being used. And guideline developers around the world really turn towards this network to have guidance. And the simple fact that lots of people use the instruments is really an attractive option for guideline developers, because it gives them a legitimacy. This is the international standard. And so there is a kind of sense that the guidelines for guidelines, there is a single standard. We don't know whether it's better than any other standard, but if you use that international standard, that gives a certain legitimacy to have those instruments used. Because there's no formal ways, there's no sanctions, we don't have to sign up for any of this. There's no formal authority associated with it.
It's in a way paradoxical that they have this position of authority and finally is a network which is difficult to grasp. I see a question, I suppose it's related to... So please.
My name is Ulrike Feld, University of Vienna, Austria. Okay, I think I can speak.
I can hear you.
Thanks a lot for the presentation. I really enjoyed the way you kind of unpacked it. And I was kind of remaining a bit kind of ambivalent towards the end because it was so neatly kind of put apart, saying how reflexive they are, and they know it's not only numbers, and they say it's not a universal standard, but you can adapt it locally. But I'm wondering how, under this guise of openness, not a particular kind of power relation imposes itself. And I would kind of like to invite you to think more critically about what this notion of internationality means. Because, of course, there are certain countries, there is an invisible map there, where certain countries get voice and not others. Then if you come to the local, and let's pretend that there is something like the local, then the question is, where is the diversity in the local? So, I mean, somebody comes, and we will speak in the next session a bit about that. And I find that so interesting. Like, we buy into this kind of standard narrative, and then we have this kind of add-on discourse saying, but at the same time, we're so flexible, and we are experts, and we have judgments. And if there is fight, I say, you know, I have the numbers, and I crunch them, and you can come and say whatever. My responsibility has been taken care of because I had the numbers and I did do my best. So I'm wondering how these people deal with responsibility and not only with accountability in dealing with these kinds of issues.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. In terms of international, yeah, you're absolutely right. They're not, I mean, they're international because there's several nations, but they're in no way global. They have some, this concerns them, they're a bit worried that they're very, you know, European, North American centered, so they have tried to encourage other countries, but it's very, very different. I think their standards are probably not very useful, they're in no way universal in that sense. This really challenges the idea that that process is universal, and there have been some discussions within that, that maybe in the first years and in my interviews, they've always been emphasizing how universal grade is, how it's valid in any country. But with new countries coming in where resources are completely different, the kinds of diseases that are dealt with are completely different, this is really being challenged, that maybe we need to adapt the agree or the grade two different countries. So it is, that is definitely challenging the idea of these standard, these meta standards, these guidelines for guidelines. And I think the idea of wanting to include countries, but only if they can follow those universal standards and imposing those standards, is it's not going to make it global. And so there is this concern, oh, we need representation from all over the world, and that is important for their own legitimacy, but I think in practice that's going to be really, really difficult. It's not, I don't think it's speaking to the issues that a lot of those countries are dealing with. In terms of kind of the way that it looks all very localized and flexible and all that, it's true, once those guidelines, the local guidelines, they're quite firmly, they have a kind of domain, and often it's very national, particularly if they're national guideline developers. So it's very within that domain, within that context, that would still be the authority, that would be the one and only standard. At the same time, there are so many different standards, there are so many different guidelines that practitioners can use other guidelines, or those who oppose them can say, well, but you know, these guidelines are all different than these guidelines. So it is a way to kind of undermine that authority of those standards. So yeah, by being localized doesn't mean they don't have authority. And I think they try really hard to make sure that that those local guidelines still have authority. This whole process is a way to do that. So it's certainly is not, you know, power-free or anything. One of the things I also have, I struggle with, is that I feel, I can see, like yesterday in one of the keynotes said that it seemed sometimes the practitioners are the best, you know, sociologists of science. I feel like, wow, they're, you know, they're so taking all these contextualizations into account, all those things. At the same time, they use very different vocabulary. They do not use anything that we would use as our theoretical concepts. And they really reject that. So I feel there is still, even though they're trying to formalize a lot of the contextualization through some of these instruments. When I, for example, would suggest that evidence is not universal, the language is still very different. There is still that commitment that, yes, evidence is universal. Even the validity and the quality differs from place to place. This language is not shared at all. And I do have difficulty with, I feel sometimes my own findings, for example, is difficult to kind of present them because they feel very criticized and attacked, whereas here, for example, it's like, well, you're being really kind to them. When I present it to them, they don't, not so much. So there is still a lot of that very different vocabulary that I'm not quite sure how to use.
Manuela.
Hi, Janice Graham, Dalhousie University, Canada. I really enjoyed your talk. But I'm kind of wondering, because I went looking, for example, in Health Canada for evidence of evidence-based medicine in the regulatory decision-making, and spent several years there, only to find that none of the evaluators in the directorate that I was looking at were using anything remotely like the McMaster evidence-based medicine that I had studied at McMaster in the early 80s. So I'm wondering, I mean, this is great in terms of platform, which is what you mentioned, but in terms of following our actor, evidence-based medicine, and the methods out into how they're actually performed in the world of regulation is kind of more needed. I mean, and yet in the work that I've done in that area, it's missing. In fact, our regulators aren't using anything remotely like the rigorous methods that we keep hearing about in all that they write about. And the same can be said for Cochrane. The same can be said for all of these, you know, sort of provincial formularies in around other countries. That I contest that we're actually seeing evidence-based methods and design. And I'm just wondering what you have to say about that.
The in terms of these guidelines for guidelines, they are very flexible themselves in some ways. That, you know, how you use them differs very much. So I have looked also at specific guidelines, how they are being produced, and a lot of it is still very invisible. A lot of, for example, using the grade is often done by the methodologists. One individual who fills out all the tables and all those things, and then it's discussed in the group. So it is, there is a lot of invisibility and a lot of things that are being obscured, and I would love to look more at how GRADE is being used in practice and how guideline developers, because there is a critique on GRADE as well, a lot of guideline developers, should we use it, should we not use it, what does it improve, what does it change the way we do things, is it actually going to make any difference? They recognize there's kind of an advantage to using the same thing that everybody else uses, but at the same time they feel like it provides so few rules and so few, too little guidance to really change that practice, so some of them really don't want it. So yeah, I would love to look at how these guidelines work out in practice, and beyond using it, but, you know, what does that mean to use it in practice? That would be a good follow-up.
Yeah, thanks very much. Question about who
can,
it
can
is.
Can you say your name?
Yes,
first.
Sorry. Ayo Welberg from the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. I was wondering if you, in your discussions with your informants, got a sense of who it is that's kind of asking for the guidelines for the guidelines. Mm-hmm. We know from work around guidelines, before the guidelines for the guidelines, that insurance companies and governments who have to pay for healthcare are often kind of key drivers behind mm-hmm. asking for guidelines because they don't want to be paying for, you know, medicine that's not working. But also doctors who are afraid of liability issues. So if you follow the guidelines, then you're following best practice, so nobody can sue you kind mm-hmm. of thing. Did you get a sense of who is kind of asking for guidelines for the guidelines? Mm-hmm. Is it the same actors or are there new actors on the...
It's very diverse because the people who develop these guidelines they develop different kinds of guidelines. Those who develop guidelines for guidelines, some are part of government organizations, some are part of professional organizations or GP organizations or health technology assessment. And so the demand for the actual guidelines is very diverse. I guess what initiated these guidelines for guidelines was a concern with the quality of guidelines and the diversity of them. And in the interviews, some of them said they felt how they were very naive in the beginning, and they had this idea that, you know, gold standards would solve a lot of these problems, the practice variations, and it would improve. And as they were, you know, getting along, they realized it wasn't that simple. And the differences, so the initial funding came from the EU to harmonize guidelines across Europe. And so this was a real impetus to say, oh, you know, we need a single guideline for EU because they want to harmonize a lot of these things. And so initially they really thought they were maybe going to harmonize guidelines, but each has their own, you know, rationales for their guidelines. And so trying to come up with which of these guidelines was better was really not. They really kind of switched to what they did agree on was the process of developing guidelines. And so the initial impetus for these guidelines agree was the initial impetus to develop this instrument, and then more and more guideline developers. It gives a response to generalized critiques. It gives a legitimacy for guidelines that are being criticized from many different sides. And so it does give guideline developers something to say, well, our guidelines have a quality assurance, and agree has also made sure that even though they give this quality, a kind of a quantitative quality mark, they have no norm, and they're very explicit about this. They do not want to have like a cutoff point to say these guidelines are good and these guidelines are bad. They're very careful in that. It measures the quality, but it does not say, you know, which ones are good or bad. So in some ways, each guideline can claim for their context it's the best one. So it does legitimize guidelines in a very kind of as a category, as I think widely legitimizes guidelines. So it probably serves a lot of different problems that guideline developers have.
We still have time for one or two questions if you like. Laurent? I'm sorry.
Oui, j'avais deux questions. La première, est-ce que, parce que tous les débats que vous évoquez sur universalisme, localisme, déclinaison contingente de principes généraux, moi, d'emblée, ça m'a fait penser au débat sur l'éthique. Alors, est-ce que vous avez fait la comparaison avec les questions d'éthique, premièrement? Et si oui, est-ce qu'il n'y a pas une variable différente qui est l'inscription historique? À savoir que pour l'éthique, évidemment, c'est le résultat d'une vieille affaire, d'une vieille histoire avec autour de la question de la morale. Et quel est l'historique, quelle est l'inscription historique de ces débats sur les guidelines? Et est-ce que vous avez fait la correspondance à la question d'éthique? Deuxièmement, alors ça
Attends,
m'a peut-être échappé.
Peut-être une question à la fois, non?
Oui, c'est déjà un peu.
Oh, la seconde est très simple. Hein.
La première ne l'est pas.
Ouais. Je sais pas. Non, mais elle est. Parce que non, je veux dire par là, c'est peut-être de ma part juste un problème de compréhension. Je n'ai pas saisi vos. Quels sont vos matériaux? De quels guidelines vous parlez? Ou est-ce que le sujet, c'est précisément de ne pas parler de guidelines particuliers? Est-ce que vous avez incarné ce propos dans des guidelines précis?
Oui, mais je vais commencer par la dernière. C'est exactement ça. Pour ces guidelines pour guidelines, le but est d'avoir des guidelines pour guidelines pour tous les guidelines. de ne pas avoir pour des... maybe I should answer in English. The question, the second question was on your material. What is it based on, specific guidelines or specific diseases or very generalized? And so it's very generalized. That they attempt to make these guidelines not specific for any domain. And so there is very different kinds. Some are in the cancer domain, some are GP domain. There's different organizations and different individuals that focus on specific diseases, but the idea is that these guidelines for guidelines are valid. Not just cross countries, but also cross domains. And so my empirical material was, for this part, was based on those guideline developers getting together every year. I participated in several meetings where they discussed making these instruments. I was an evaluator using Agree to evaluate guidelines. I participated in workshops to explain these guidelines, etc. And all, none of... So these guidelines are not disease-specific, and quite a lot operates on international level with international congresses, people getting together, etc. I also did observations of specific guidelines, more focused on oncology, really looking at how an individual specific guideline is produced, but that was not what I was talking about here. The other question was about kind of parallels with ethics and... I have not quite understood the question, perhaps, but in terms of the kinds of ethical principles and morals that are being invoked, values is the term values or ethical principles is very much invoked in a way that... That is less, and values is something that is very much something that is national or cultural, very close to cultural, not the kind of moral, universal values of our moral ethicism, but more values are considered usually very national, which is very questionable. But the idea that values are an important base for guidelines as well. They need to be taken into account to have the right standards in the right context. But it's a very vague category, and a lot of different things can fall under that. In terms of a historical kind of background to those things, I think they're fairly pragmatic and practical instruments that they really want to be used in practice. And there's a kind of more meta discussions amongst those guideline developers of what are their own ethical values that go into the grade, for example, as part of their exchanges. There are those debates amongst the developers, and they don't necessarily agree on that. But it's not something that gets built into it in a kind of an instrumental way directly, even if it's being discussed.
Last question.
Thank you for sharing your research with us. I think I will expose my ignorance. And I just want to, I was wondering how AGRI and the two instruments you, AGRI and GRID, became the two guidelines for guidelines. Mm-hmm. Are there other instruments? And what is the process?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are other instruments. There is, in fact, a diversity in guidelines for guidelines. There are, for example, the Institute of Medicine in the US has their own standards for standards, which is very similar to Agree, that says, you know, a good guideline development should include all these different elements that have eight domains and those kinds of things. However, where they differ, and I think this is where Agree became much more used and more useful, in that Agree provides this test. It's not just an ideal that people are supposed to live up to, but kind of outsiders can use it to really evaluate guidelines, individual guidelines, and give it a quality score, something that the other guidelines for guidelines don't do. They only provide the ideal, but they don't really provide a way to say these guidelines do live up to the IDEA and those don't. There's much discussion on whether Agree itself or great for that matter, is evidence-based. What is the evidence base for these instruments? There isn't, in the sense that those guidelines don't necessarily follow their own methodological procedures. The Institute of Medicine standard for standard has been evaluated towards their own standards, and an article criticizing these standards saying, well, you, the way you developed your guidelines for guidelines, you only used, you know, half of the different domains that you say should be. So yeah, there is still much controversy around it. At the same time, the Guidelines International Network does have hundreds of members around the world. Agree is used, for example, in Canada, has been used to evaluate guidelines before they enter a database for cancer. So all those cancer guidelines are evaluated with that. GRADE is used by hundreds of guideline developers around the world. So they are widely used, but they're not. They are also still kind of criticized and somewhat controversial.
I think. Thank you so much, Luz, for an interesting discussion.